This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, this is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. The COVID-19 pandemic has us battling crises on multiple fronts. And complicating matters is the abundance of information, including false and misleading information, that's really muddying our understanding of what actions need to be taken to stay safe amid the pandemic. The World Health Organization calls this crisis of COVID-19 misinformation as an infodemic. So what kind of tools are needed to address this misinformation crisis? That's what I'll be asking Dr. David Robert Grimes, scientist and author of the book, The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. David, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The Irrational Ape was first published in September 2019, and it's quite prescient, really, given the pandemic and infodemic that we find ourselves in and the consequences of health misinformation that we're dealing with today. When you wrote the book, did you ever anticipate that it would have the relevance that it does today?
I think the reason I wrote it is that I knew this was going to be a problem. And in fact, from what I did on the ground, I could see it already was a problem. We live in a very paradoxical age because on one hand, we have better access to information than we have ever had before. Previous generations couldn't just go on Google and find things. The downside of that is that we have never been more exposed to falsehood and poisonous fictions than ever before in human history. And all these faults in our logic, which we've always had, they're not new faults. They have suddenly come to the forefront because now when we're overwhelmed with information, particularly some of it misleading or wrong, it's very hard for most people to sift between the two of them. And that puts us in a very, very hazardous position, I think.
So you talk about this paradoxical age where we have all the information at our fingertips, but at the same time, we're kind of drowned in information. Is it simply down to the availability of technology and social media? I mean, if this pandemic were to happen in the 1990s, for example, do you think the magnitude of misinformation would be as severe?
The magnitude probably would be severe. If we look at the history of pandemics and the history of disasters that have hit humans, the one constant in all of these things has been misinformation. When the bubonic plague was happening in the 14th century, people were blaming Jews for it, and there was conspiracy theories about them at the time. Mm-hmm. During Spanish flu, there were conspiracy theories as well. What really is different now is the volume and the accessibility of those conspiracy theories. So once they go mainstream, so to speak, once they are easy to share, they tend to spread, like the virus themselves. I think information is pathogenic and misinformation is particularly pathogenic. It can infect people. So what is different is not the human condition per se, but just the availability of it. We have always been predisposed to believing false narratives. The problem now is it's so much easier to find other people that also have these beliefs and to spread them among each other. And that is something that was always going to be a problem because of the infrastructure of social media. But I need to emphasize that social media didn't create these problems. It's just exacerbated them.
Right, right. That's such an interesting point. And your book emphasizes that the key to dealing with misinformation, which is a natural human condition that's existed for millennia, the key to addressing it is to enhance critical thinking. And I want to go into what critical thinking is. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is a general perception that, if you're a science student or you studied science, then you have critical thinking skills. But there was a recent study by US researchers that showed people who trust in science, they're still susceptible to misinformation in that data which sounds scientific is more likely to be believed whether or not it's actually true. So, simply believing in science or simply saying that, oh, I trust the science, that really isn't the same as being a critical thinker, is it?
No, it's not. That's a really good observation. I think that critical thinking is an active process. We're all capable of it. And we can all do it. The problem is it's not intuitive. We have a kind of, a quick mode that we all run, a default mode, where we say, well, that looks okay. Or we kind of very lightly parse information and go, yeah, that looks scientific. That's fine, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is, of course, and we've seen this particularly during the pandemic to a huge degree, that there is a thing called cargo cult science, which is stuff that has the trappings of science. It looks scientific, but it is anything but. And I think that's very easy to fall for. We've seen it with drugs over COVID, or alleged cures or alleged bits of anti-vaccine information wrapped up looking like they're scientific and not being anything like it. Critical thinking is a more involved process. You really have to learn what questions to ask before you accept information. But it is learnable, which is the good news.
Let's take an example. So using the example of the debate over ivermectin as a drug to treat COVID-19. So we see that the arguments in support of ivermectin are couched in scientific language most of the time. The majority of the world's health authorities, you know, at best they're neutral, or at worst they've dismissed these claims, but it doesn't stop people from demanding access to ivermectin. So what do you think is at play here? How should we critically view the information on ivermectin and, you know, other cures for COVID-19 in a way that would actually help us?
What's really the important question for any medicine, whether it's ivermectin or anything, any approved treatment for COVID, what you really need to ask is, what's the evidence base and what is the reliable information on this? So when you take a drug like ivermectin, which by the way is an excellent anti-parasitic drug, it's existed for a long time. Why would this anti-parasite medication be effective for COVID? That doesn't rule it out, but you ask that question first, right? Because COVID is obviously a virus. So, and then you ask, okay, what's the evidence base for it? And if you go to reputable sources and look at the evidence base, for example, they're very poor. Just last month, the Cochrane collaboration, which is one of the, I suppose, gold standards in medical trials, looked at the evidence for ivermectin and simply said, no, there's no reliable evidence of efficacy. Now, it's still being tested in some places, and people that are promoting it often say, oh, look, it's being trialed. So are 320 other agents we already have. Now, this whole picture is confused a little bit because we mentioned a few minutes ago cargo cult science and things that have a trappings of science but really are not science. Mm-hmm. There was two reviews that came out recently that seemed to say, and they looked scientific, that ivermectin had some benefit. They've both since been retracted, and they've been retracted because other scientists looked at them and said, no, this is not true when you analyze the data properly. So I think that there's a little bit of wishful thinking that goes on as well. So straight off the bat for your listeners, there is no medical evidence that ivermectin has any effect. And that is why public health bodies like the EMA and the WHO and the CDC, and the FDA in America are not recommending it, because it doesn't have any evidence base. But the reason why these narratives are so appealing is it's a very simple answer. It's a very simple, this will cure you and you'll be fine. Other people who are pushing it also claim it will immunize you against COVID. That is definitely not true. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. But you've got to realize that this often comes from circles that also push anti-vaccine misinformation and disinformation. Mm-hmm. And you might wonder, why are they doing that? Well, if they can tell you that some well-known agent will protect you from COVID, you don't need a vaccine. But that sounds very reassuring to people that already kind of believe that.
Right.
So I think the other thing that we learned from this is, if that information appeals to you, if any information appeals to you, you need to, you know, interrogate it twice as hard as you would interrogate information that agreed with your prejudices. That's very hard for us to do. We like to look around and find the first thing that agrees with what we believe or what we feel and go, ah, that proves it.
Because real, it makes us feel good, yeah.
100% and reassured. That's really important. It makes us feel like we're in control. We have an understanding of a situation. Whereas real critical thinking often involves really analyzing and interrogating information that might chime with your beliefs and going, is that really true? And that can be very disconcerting, but it's a habit we really have to get into.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the point you made about reputable sources and making sure that the source of information, we want to check where it comes from to see if it's actually credible. So how do we deal then with misinformation that comes from medical professionals or scientific figures of authority who are typically seen as trusted sources? I mean, we have doctors who say ivermectin should be used as a treatment. So how do we deal with that?
That's an excellent question. I actually wrote for Scientific American about this just a few weeks ago, because it has been one of the real nadirs, one of the real worst parts of the pandemic for me, is seeing people abusing their scientific and medical credentials to hawk pseudoscience. Now, there's a very important lesson underneath it, though. Scientists and doctors only ever have any authority when they are reflecting the evidence base. They have no intrinsic authority. I am only being a scientist when I am reflecting the evidence base accurately. Mm. If I go off piste and start making things up, the fact that I'm a scientist doesn't shield me from being wrong, and it doesn't shield me from being damaging. So what I always say is, if you hear an individual scientist offering, you know, a narrative that is very much at odds with, say, a more reputable body of many, many scientists, that should ring your alarm bells.
Right. So I guess the takeaway is we shouldn't deify scientists. Just because they're scientists doesn't mean that they're always right.
No, we should deify evidence. A scientist doing their job correctly will present the evidence even-handedly, and that's how they make their conclusions. But this is why I always say consensus of evidence matters. It's not about one bit of evidence or two bits of evidence in isolation. It's about what the whole picture tells you. If I can give you an example I find brilliant. Many years ago, there was a petition to ban dihydrogen monoxide. It's a chemical. It's found in food. It kills hundreds of thousands of people a year. We find it in nuclear power plants. We find it in acid rain. We find it in human tumors. Mm-hmm. And there's been petitions to ban it because, you know, it kills so many people. But dihydrogen monoxide is H2O. It's water, mm-hmm. right? And the point is, everything we've said there about water is true, but it's selective. It's a misrepresentation of the evidence. It's not telling you the whole picture about it. And unfortunately, there, a good scientist should give you the whole picture. There's always going to be ones that don't. And that's just something for people to be aware of. What matters is the totality of evidence together.
I'm speaking to David Robert Grimes, author of the book, The Irrational Ape. When we come back, how do we tackle conspiracy theories? Stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and scientist David Robert Grimes is with me on The Breakfast Grill today. He's the author of The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. David, I want to talk a little bit about conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theories are in a class of their own, and we've seen several crop up during the pandemic. I mean, there was a Pew Research survey recently that showed one in four Americans believe that the COVID-19 virus was intentionally manufactured. And there's also the bizarre claims that the COVID-19 vaccines contain a chip that will enable us to be controlled by Microsoft founder Bill Gates. Why are things that are so unbelievable to the average person held up to be infallible by others? I mean, how do we explain the allure of conspiracy theories?
You know, that's an excellent question. And when I was writing the book, what I didn't initially anticipate was how much psychology would end up being in it. Because when you start going down the road of why do people believe this? It's not just like people believe this, this is wrong, but asking why people embrace them, you end up having to confront an awful lot about human psychology. And so I think people are searching for meaning all the time. And one thing that conspiracies offer is a thing called epistemic certainty. They offer a narrative of the world that gives you a sense of control. Now, it might be the most odious, terrible narrative ever, but you feel that you know it, that you understand it. And if you strip most conspiracy theories down to it, they're simple black and white. They're good guy versus bad guy. Mm. There's no nuance in them. There's no randomness. Everything is planned and you either are aware of it or you're not. So that gives a sense. It's an illusory sense, but it gives a sense of what's called epistemic certainty. We have an aversion to randomness. As human beings, we don't like stochasticity. We don't like the fact that things aren't always planned, aren't always in our control. It is easier for some people to believe that Bill Gates has manipulated a giant, vast, odious global conspiracy than to accept the fact that viruses randomly mutate and even a non-living thing could have caused this much damage to our lives in a relatively short space of time. Mm. Because that second belief is more frightening to them because there's no sense of control in it. There's no one pulling the strings. The other thing that's really important to realize why people are drawn to this is mundane explanations never really interest us. What really appeals to us as humans are things that grip our emotional side.
Right.
We're not just computers that sit there and calculate the world. We have feelings. And conspiracy theories offer a powerful feeling explanation. They offer something that makes us angry or makes us outraged at someone or makes us scared. And these emotions are powerful. And there is a certain appeal in that as well. So that has made us very vulnerable to conspiracy theory because actually they're much more, on one level, satisfying explanations than the facts, or at least emotionally they're more satisfying. It gives a meaning to it and a reason. And the truth is there's sometimes no meaning. There's sometimes no reason. Mm. We just live in a very random world and that's scary.
That is scary. And I want to talk a bit about how we deal with this kind of emotional argument as we discuss about vaccines and the vaccine effort. So the world is racing to vaccinate the population to stop COVID-19, but there are concerns that a sizable segment of society will impede these efforts by refusing to take the vaccine. So we know that the anti-vaccine movement, they're not a monolith. And you've written about how it really lies on a spectrum. So how do we differentiate between the diehard anti-vaxxer, who I would also assume is a conspiracy theorist of sorts, and the person who is vaccine hesitant? I mean, how different are their motivations, really?
You're absolutely correct that the absolute vaccine deniers are shades of conspiracy theorists, because the only way you can believe that is to ignore the overwhelming scientific evidence and think that all scientists and doctors are in on it. And that makes you a conspiracy theorist. But you're correct. Vaccine hesitancy is a spectrum. So obviously we do sometimes simplify to anti-vaxxer, pro-vaxxer. That's not really true. People are different shades of things. Now, we're talking about the extremes when we say anti-vax and pro-vax. But what happens is we're humans again, going back to the last point. Information nudges a certain way. If you're on the fence and you are constantly exposed to negative information, even if it's false information about vaccines, it's going to nudge you further and further towards rejection. Equally, if you're on the fence and you keep hearing great things, it's going to nudge you towards positive things. And that's essentially a trait of being human. Mm. Now, what makes the anti-vaccine movement a little bit interesting, and when I say anti-vaccine, I'm talking about those extreme deniers, the people who make up the disinformation in the first place, because it has to come from somewhere. And those people are evangelizing. They're deliberately spreading it. So let's call them the anti-vaxxers for the sake of this argument, okay? They're not a new thing. I think people often get surprised. They've been around since, I have a pamphlet here, a copy of it, from the year 1772. Mm-hmm. Called The Dangerous and Sinful Practice of Inoculation, right? So the anti-vaccine movement's been around a very long time. It's an ideological movement, and it's very tied in with a naturalistic movement that man-made interventions are bad. This is a very common theme that comes into it. They do, and they have been excellent at abusing the internet. And this is even before social media. Anti-vaccine activists were able to get websites that people went to. They got more traffic. The advent of social media has made their life so much easier. And we know from scientific literature that parents exposed to anti-vaccine conspiracy theories online become far more afraid and far more reticent to vaccinate their kids. We also know that anti-vaccine propaganda is designed to scare people. That is designed to be emotive. It's designed to be frightening. It's designed to stick in our heads. Because we have a thing called the availability heuristic, where we weigh information that's more sensational or more accessible to us as being more important because we can remember it. It's a bit of a circular logic. Mm-hmm. That's more important because I can remember it because it's more important. It is circular, but we do it. And anti-vaccine activists have been absolutely brilliant in one way at exploiting this. And when you're scared, people share information, even though they're not anti-vaxxers, they're not dyed in the wool against vaccination. They see this frightening information and they feel like they need to warn other people. I heard this. Either to warn them or get reassurance. And that actually is exactly what anti-vaccine propaganda thrives on, because then people share it. And the more people that are exposed, the more people become afraid. And that's something critical thinking stands in the way here as well. Because if something is making you emotional, if something is making you afraid, then you really have to question, is this real information or are you relying on my human propensity to react to this, to exploit me? And oftentimes the answer to that is yes.
Okay, so that's the intervention that you need to do. If you're reading something or seeing something that elicits these really strong feelings, then you want to maybe check yourself and just ask, what is this aimed at?
Absolutely. I think one of the things I'd argue very strongly for a concept called information hygiene. So we all knew during the early stage of the pandemic that, wearing protective clothing or masks or whatever was useful, or gloves and whatever we had in different countries. But a similar level of we have to start viewing information as potentially infectious and potentially, like a virus, very damaging. So when we come across new information, we almost have to treat it like it's pathogenic. We have to put it at a distance. We have to put it in quarantine. And before we accept it or share it to anyone, before we embrace it, we need to go, is that actually true? Particularly if it makes us emotional. It's those little checks that we have to do when we come across this information. that we or potential disinformation, we have to have information hygiene and not allow it to infect us. Because if we spread it on to other people, we've already been infected.
Your book puts forth different ways the individual can sift between the signal and noise in our media consumption. Can this be translated to broader government policy? What would enhancing critical thinking as policy action look like?
That's a really good question. And I've been kind of vocal on this recently in Europe. And what keeps coming up in discussions with policymakers and councils I sit on is that essentially, you know, social media is an unregulated environment that propagates these. It's like a massive vector of disinformation. Now, social media companies will make all the noise in the world about caring about disinformation and wanting to help. I'm going to go on the record as saying I think that is an absolute lie. I don't think it's in their financial interests for them to do it. Mm-hmm. You look at these communities of disinformation, they are incredibly active users who spend a lot of time on these websites. They don't want to lose that revenue. There was a report from the Center for Countering Digital Hate recently that found during the pandemic, the top 12 anti-vaccine accounts made 36 million. But the social media companies made over a billion on the back of those accounts through advertising. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing we can do from a policy point of view is, apart from in schools encouraging the teaching of critical thinking, I think really what we need to do is have massive regulation of social media companies to hold them accountable. I think that's going to be a pan-national effort. These companies are so big that no one government can say, hey, sort your platform out. It's going to take a massive global effort, and that could take years. In the interim, all we can do from a policy level is to, in schools, encourage the teaching of critical thinking and media literacy. I think that's really important too, because it's not just social media, it's how we parse all media. And from policy view, I think that's what we can do now. Long term, I think we're going to have to wrestle with social media and how it has affected things.
Let's end the conversation on this note, David. What advice do you have for those of us who are struggling to have conversations with family or friends who believe questionable COVID-19 information? And this could be about vaccines, and this, or this could be about questionable treatment. But these discussions are often emotive and they're difficult. What kind of tips do you have?
Yeah, and it doesn't help when people get angry and start shouting at each other. That never helps, although it is often the end point. So what I would say is, I think conversation is much more important than debate. I think it's really important when you're dealing with family members and friends to listen to what they say and then ask, even if you know it to be incorrect, and then ask, why do you think that? And listen to what they explain. And often when they're explaining that, you find that their fears might be something totally unrelated, that they've latched onto this because when they were looking up their fear, these other people kind of went and sent them some disinformation that's got tied up in it. The question I often ask people is, all right, that's really interesting. What information could I give you that would help you change your mind? What would change your mind on this? And oftentimes people say, well, if you could show me X, Y, and Z, that would change my mind. And often you can. I often ask people, so where did you get that information from? And then when they've given me this, when I've let them speak, I go, okay, I totally understand where you're coming from. Because you never want to dehumanize people, because that will shut them down immediately. What you always want to do is plant the seed. You're never going to, no one ever changes anyone else's mind. You just give people the tools to change their own. So instead of making it a fight, I would say, well, look, you think this and here's the reasons I don't, but would you just think about that for me and I'll think about yours, you know? Oftentimes, if you give people the freedom to change their own mind, they will. And on, sometimes in conversation, we even find out our own position is wrong. It is a glorious thing to change your mind. It's not a weakness, it's a strength. The only weakness is refusing to change your mind when the evidence demands it. And that's something we all have to move towards, not judging each other for it, just being free to change our minds as the evidence demands.
David, that's a perfect note to end the conversation. Thanks so much for your time and insights.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to scientist and author David Robert Grimes. His book is titled The Irrational Ape: Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. This has been The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.